Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are also available. I'm Peter Orner, Professor of Creative Writing at San Francisco State and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our guest, Michael Krasny. For 20 years, award-winning journalist Michael Krasny has been bringing lively, intelligent discussion of public affairs, literature, and the arts to listeners around the Bay Area and the nation. The host of KQED Public Radio's Forum, Dr. Krasny has interviewed an astonishing number of notable figures who have passed through San Francisco, including Jimmy Carter, Cesar Chavez, Noam Chomsky, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Francis Ford Coppola, Don DeLillo, Newt Gingrich, Al Gore, Norman Mailer, Toni Morrison, Barack Obama, Rosa Parks, Nancy Pelosi, Robert Redford, Philip Roth, Salman Rushdie, Desmond Tutu, John Updike, and I'm going to add a few of my own: John Irving, Joyce Carol Oates, V.S. Naipaul, Mike Tyson recently, Studs Terkel, Madeleine Albright this past year, and the list could go on and on and on. To mark Dr. Krasny's distinguished 20-year career at KQED, San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee even declared February 15, 2013, Michael Krasny Day. Before coming to KQED Public Radio in 1993, Dr. Krasny hosted a nighttime talk program for KGO Radio and co-anchored the weekly KGO television show Night Focus. He has also served as a host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. Since 1970, he has been a professor of English at San Francisco State University and has taught at Stanford and the University of California. He's the author of Spiritual Envy, An Agnostic's Quest, An Off-Mic, A Memoir of Talk Radio and Literary Life. Dr. Krasny is also a widely published scholar and literary critic and the recipient of many awards, including the S.Y. Agnon Gold Medal for Intellectual Distinction, the Gene Block Award for Human Rights Journalism, the Inclusiveness in Media Award from the National Conference for Community and Justice, and a Corrette Foundation Fellowship. He has been named Best Talk Show Host by Focus Magazine and a number of Bay Area newspapers, including and other outlets, including the San Francisco Publicity Club and City Search. Dr. Krasny received his BA and MA degrees from Ohio State University. That's correct. Where he is a member of Phi Beta Kappa and his PhD degree, and received his PhD from the University of Wisconsin. And I just want to add, before we welcome Michael, that, you know, people in San Francisco and elsewhere in the nation have called him correctly, I think, a Bay Area institution. But something about that doesn't quite get at, I believe, the significance of Michael Krasny to our daily lives. And in fact, to me and to many of you, I'm sure, Michael's voice and his program is a part of the fabric of our lives. 9 o'clock hits, and there the music is cued, and I'm driving my kid to preschool, and she's fighting me to play that monkey song that she loves. But, you know, I fight for Forum, and, you know, she's going to learn. She's only three. But but every single day, you know, and it has become, I think, very much, you know, an incredibly important part of my life, and I know so many others. And one of the questions we're going to ask Michael is, how do you do it? Well, we'll get to that. But I want to start by, first of all, having a warm Commonwealth Club welcome for Michael Krasny. So,
can I ask you a question first, Peter?
Yeah.
How did it feel to hit that gavel?
It was awesome. I really enjoyed that. Yeah. One day I'm going to go into politics.
Just a quick anecdote, I'm sorry, because when I saw you hit the gavel, I thought, you know, it gives you a sense of something that you've never done before and perhaps, well, enacting a very symbolic act. Recently, I was asked to MC the Academy Award live feed at the Raphael Theater in San Rafael, and I know some of you are thinking, am I hearing this voice with this face, but I get used to it. So I'm at the Raphael Theater, and it was sanctioned by the Academy. They had programs from the Academy and so forth. And at the end of the program, I couldn't help myself. I said, I've waited my whole life to say this. I want to thank the Academy.
Sorry.
Sort of like hitting a gavel a little bit.
Exactly. And I started tentatively, but I got into it very quickly. You learn quickly how to hit that gavel. We're here tonight to celebrate your career on KQED as well. Questions already. But I want to kind of take a step back and sort of give it totality here, at least in terms of your career in public life and as a writer. We're here to talk about Michael's career as a public servant, as a questioner, as a listener, as a writer, as a reader, and as a teacher. And I separate them out, but they're very much things that all go together in terms of what you do. But I wanted to start with the public servant aspect. I was listening to an interview you did with Neil Conan on National Public Radio, and you actually refer to yourselves, including Neil Conan, as public servants. And I'm wondering how you and when you hear that word public servant these days, it doesn't always indicate people who are providing a public service. Sometimes I think that, you know, our public servants aren't quite doing that as much as we know they should be doing. How do you see your responsibility as a public servant?
I like to think of it in terms of bringing light and helping to foster citizenship and being an educator, which is really what I am in my DNA to a great degree, into the marrow of my bones. And I think when you're serving the public, and public radio was designed to, in its original mission, really to serve the public in all of those ways that bring knowledge, bring sometimes serious dialogue, sometimes lighter and more entertaining kinds of programs, but things that come into your life and we like to think expand your life, broaden your life, make your lives richer, but also make you more aware of what's going on in the news, what's going on in terms of not only what you read in the news, but what's behind what you read in the news, and an opportunity to meet and to find out from people who come on the air who are experts and who are educators in their own right, or scientists or novelists or working in the arts, what's behind those people's thinking, and to hope that it enriches your lives. But a lot of it's about citizenship, really, in my mind, about making a stronger democracy just by having a more informed citizenry.
But, I mean, we see that on television and other types of radio, a much different discourse. And it seems when I'm listening to Forum, you are able to steer the conversation, even when it's in very controversial subjects. I'm thinking recently of the past few months, the coverage of the Newtown shootings. This past week, we had the anniversary of the Iraq invasion. And yet, it's never a food fight on Forum. And I'm wondering how you deal with this challenge of actually getting disparate people to speak to each other directly.
You know, a number of years ago, Deborah Tannen, who's a linguist some of you may be familiar with, wrote a book called The Argumentative Culture, and I thought she really said things that ought to have been said long before that about how, I mean, your food fight is a good way to describe it. That's as good a metaphor as any. You see Fox News, I don't want to necessarily single them out, it's on even MSNBC, CNN, where people are yelling at each other, and there's not the kind of higher level discourse that, frankly, I've always believed in. I always felt, even when I was in commercial radio, it's why things probably didn't work out when I was working for ABC, I always believed in a higher level of discourse, and I think it's fascinating because I have an innate curiosity to find out how people disagree and where you can find ways to maybe find common ground, but really to get those disagreements out there in a civil way and in a way which one hopes and trusts can bring light.
Just one example, when you were talking about the Iraq war, you asked a question. I was taking notes while I was driving, so I might not have my exact quote right, but you said,
to caution you against that.
You said, how do you, and you were asking, I believe it was, you were talking about why we went in but you were also speaking to servicemen servicemen and women and also their spouses on the program. And you asked somebody, how do you suppose people who went to fight a war, how do you support people who went to fight a war you didn't agree with? Mm-hmm. And it seems like questions like this are what seem to elicit You know, because that's a very difficult question. I'm just wondering, do you form these ahead of time? Do you go out of your way to ask these types of questions that seem to go deeper? How do you do it?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think about it like a bat in a cave. You know, there's a kind of radar operating. But I can tell you that I do a lot of preparation. I'm pretty assiduous about preparing for a program, which means I want to find out as much as I can beforehand that will stimulate me to think. But I also want to think on my feet. And a lot of the challenge is how your curiosity is going to serve you when you're thinking on your feet. It's always been part of really what I enjoy doing and what I feel passionate about doing. And sometimes, you know, I can find myself going off in a direction that isn't necessarily going to be all that enlightening or useful. But nevertheless, I'd like to trust my curiosity and feel that I'm going to be curious in a way that others would be curious. And usually it serves me pretty well.
I want to ask you about another aspect of the program, and one that I think that makes it especially unique, and that is that in addition to covering important national issues, and we're going to talk about more cultural stuff and literature in a moment, but Forum has a very strong focus on local issues, local politics, environmental stuff. You did a program this past week on the museum issues going on in San Francisco. Ross Mercurimi showed up on your program, lots of issues there. Rosa Pack was on this morning. Is it your decision, or is that how did it come about that Forum has such a local focus?
Do any of you remember Kevin Persglove, just out of curiosity? Well, Kevin was my predecessor. He was the host of Forum for roughly about 5 years when I came on and took over the host. He went off to become the spokesperson for San Jose, in fact, for then Mayor Susan Hammer. And after that, he became very rich because he was a spokesman for eBay. so I can sit back and look at his good fortune and feel things worked out pretty well for him. But the program was a local one, largely. And when I took over as a host, I really felt I wanted to expand it. I wanted not only to do the arts, but I also wanted to talk about a wide range of topics and talk about state, national and international stories. And to some extent, you know, this is going to be guided presumably in a collective way, decision making. We only had two producers. We have a senior editor now, which used to be my job, but I was glad to pass the torch. And we have sort of still pretty much two producers, although we also have somebody who handles online and social network stuff. Amanda Stupai recently joined up. At any rate, we make collective decisions. We look at the news and we decide what is... And for example, today we talked about Devil's Slide, and I was feeling guilty. I thought, maybe we should be talking about Israel, you know, Barack Obama's there. And it's a delicate balance sometimes, but what we're really trying to do is present a diversity. If you turn on the program in the morning, you're not going to necessarily know what we're going to be talking about. I mean, if it's a big story, Newtown, unfortunately, 9/11, I mean, or even a story to be, one hopes, joyous about, it's probably going to be what we're going to be talking about. We're going to get the best people on that we can, and a wide range of voices, to be sure, or even dissenting and conflicting voices. But it's always going to be, I hope, on a higher level. And that's really what we aim for, to put the bird up, so to speak, into the air, and to make it informative, and to make it, if possible, as engaging and compelling as we can. And that means a selective process. But we're always playing off each other. We're saying, well, don't you think we should be talking about Cyprus? but wait a minute, you know, Rose Pack was just on the cover of San Francisco Magazine, and we've never had her on. And she's a power broker, you know, although she hates that title.
She does not like that title.
We got into a whole semantic thing about, you know, would you call me a power broker as a white citizen? You know, I went into that sort of thing. But that's the challenge, and kind of in some ways the fun of trying to decide every day, what are we going to do today? And being on top of the news, including breaking news, which can be not only challenging, but can be very formidable. You know, to come in, for example, and have a breaking story and have to get it on the air and get the best people we can. I tell you, you know, if I didn't say this in a way to make it sound self-serving, you really have to appreciate the work that the people who work with me do behind the scenes. I mean that self-serving in terms of Forum, not in terms of me personally. Because I'm there behind the microphone, but the decision-making is a collective one. people like Dan Zoll, who's now my senior editor, and producers Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell, and the what we call the engagement producer, Amanda, are as much on top of things, if in case many cases more so than I am. And so we come to decisions and resolutions about what to do day after day.
I think one of the most exciting things is when you turn on the radio, you really don't know. So Devil's Slide today I thought was fascinating. It wasn't something I thought about very much. And so I think that's what actually makes the program different than other national talk programs, that you can pretty much predict what they're going to be talking about. On your program, it really, you know, and it, I think, you know, you mentioned Tip O'Neill earlier, you know, all politics is local, all literature is local, all life is local. And to not have that local angle, I think, is missing from a lot of programs, and why what I appreciate so much about it. So we'll have time to talk about maybe specific local issues, because I have some questions on those. But I wanted to get...
But I should say one other thing, Peter, just a footnote. It's always a decision-making process, because, you know, sometimes we know something's going to be covered on NPR, on Talk of the Nation, or covered before us, or we have a guest, for example, who's coming into town, and that guest will be appearing on Terry Gross before we have an opportunity to have, and we don't want to replicate. So... It's always a judgment call.
I want to step back even further and talk about how you got into this in the first place. When you first broke into radio, you were already a professor. You had studied literature intensely. You were writing. What made you make the move into radio in the first place?
Neurosis. No, I was feeling antsy, and I became a tenured professor at a fairly young age, and I thought I wasn't doing enough politically. I wasn't doing enough, really, frankly, to serve the public and in my community. And I thought those are important things. They were always part of my idealization of what somebody should be doing and contributing. And I thought, well, maybe I could do some news analysis, because I put some things into print in that realm. Or editorials, this sort of thing, maybe even film reviews. I wasn't sure what it was that I wanted to do at that point. And I did some news editorials and didn't really feel all that comfortable doing them. We're talking about antiquity here almost, you know, where the technology was something that you would think of in the Smithsonian now almost, you know. I mean, I went out in the early 80s to be a broadcaster, and a guy I was friendly with, Fred Zender, who was news director at KTVU television channel 2, gave me a slot to do editorials with Reg Murphy, who was the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner at the time. And it was almost embarrassing, because he was known by everybody and I was known by no one. And people would say, you know, who's this guy with Reg Murphy? But I'd have to go in front of the camera and be like an actor. You know, there were very few cue cards or anything of that sort. There was no teletype. I had to memorize my lines, and I felt it was so quick, and so much emphasis was on the visuals. You know, let's shoot it at Treasure Island, or let's shoot it, you know, on the bridge or whatever. That I thought maybe radio is, you know, more theater than mine, more stuff that I could work with better. And I went to this little station in Marin County at the time, which doesn't exist anymore. I was living in Marin. It was an alternative radio station. And Marin was very much identified at the time with hedonism and hot tubs and peacock feathers. There was an NBC special, in fact, that talked about Marin in that world, in that context. And I thought, maybe there are other sides of Marin. You know, there are people doing hospice work, and there are people who are dedicated to working in rehabilitation with drug addicts and so forth. Maybe I could do something along those lines and really feature these kind of people and highlight them. I wanted to learn about them. I also wanted to learn about the famous people who lived in Marin. I mean, Santana and George Lucas and Jerry Garcia and all those people. And so I set out to do a program on this little small alternative radio station. And then I was kind of discovered by KGO, which is a whole other story. And
You start in commercial radio.
That's right.
You know, and
with ABC, KGO. Yeah.
Right, ABC affiliate, KGO. What was it like to move from the commercial to public radio? Did some of your style develop at KGO? It must have, right? I mean,
when I was at KGO, they said you sound too much like public radio. When I was in public radio, they said you sound too much like commercial radio. When I started in public radio.
What were they getting at?
You know, the thing they wanted in commercial radio, they wanted to, they were obviously ratings minded all the time, and they wanted you to, had one program director who used to say, think of it as a party. You want as many people in the room as you can get there, and you want to keep them there as long as you can, and ideally you want them to be banging the dashboard. And I thought, hey, this is not necessarily in conjunction with my character. Or how I see myself, but you know, I did like to editorialize. I don't mind telling you, there were times when I came on and did news commentary and news analysis in ways that were editorial, and I could get it not to a fever pitch exactly, but get myself roused and talk in ways that I thought at least approached what they were looking for. But I knew I was really not a fit for that. And when I went into public radio, you know, I kind of had the feeling initially that this necessarily wasn't a fit either, to be perfectly honest about it. But as time went on, I realized that with Dan Shore, a name many of you may recall, who was a kind of heroic figure to many of us on Nixon's enemies list,
right.
Dan Shore said, when I went into public broadcasting, I felt like I was in the promised land. And the reason for that is very simple, because I could keep the discourse high without feeling the kind of pressures about ratings. And the ratings, by the way, I'm glad to say, have continued to go up. And we are now, I say this with some degree of pride, we are now number one in this market, which for a public radio station is very unusual. I mean, you're going against all the morning zoos and all the rest of this kind of stuff.
This is a question from an audience member that relates to what we're talking about. You were many years ago involved in debates on Sunday night on KGO. I believe you were with KSFO at the time. Have some of your basic beliefs changed since then? How have your basic beliefs
changed? I think I'm being confused with someone else here. There was a guy who was a regular debater named Bernie Ward, who debated the late Lee Rogers. You know, Lee was on the right, Bernie was on the left, and they debated regularly until Bernie was arrested and sent to prison. That's a whole other story. Lee just passed away. And KSFO was an offshoot of ABC. We used to call it Zig Heil on your dial because what they decided they wanted to do was get a large audience, and the best way to do this was to be right-wing, and they put all essentially, not even conservative, but uber-conservative right-wing people, and the station is still like that. I mean, you turn it on in the morning, and this ex-weatherman, Brian Sussman, who called me a socialist, he's on there with Melanie Morgan now, and they're kind of stirring things up for the right wing, and that's what they represent. Now, when I started out at KQED, I would put people on from the Hoover Institution. I would put people on who represent a very conservative point of view in the recognition that even if you were against those people, even if you were in opposition to them politically, you ought to know where they stand and you ought to know what they believed in. And that was all the fair idea of idealization of discourse, of fair discourse. I can't tell you how many people were angry at me for doing that initially. I mean, I've conditioned listeners to accept it to a greater degree.
It happened this week. Somebody got angry at you for having somebody from the Heritage Foundation.
That's right.
On the radio. So how?
It's like, this is our public airways. How can you put supporters of George W. Bush on or things like that?
Right.
You know, I mean, I got a lot of that initially.
Yeah.
Much more than you could imagine. But
when you pushed back, did you get, and what kind of pressure did you get inside the organization or outside, or what? I mean, were you free to do what you wanted at that point?
I was. In fact, that's one thing I have to say, not only about public broadcasting, but about even KGO. They wanted me to ramp it up at KGO. They wanted me to be, I remember a program director put Madonna's sex book in my mailbox and said, Kraz, you got to talk to the younger demographics. This is the way to go, you know. So, I mean, this is a guy who said to me after I was so proud of the fact I had Doris Lessing, a Nobel Prize winning novelist, Jessica Mitford, you know, one of the greatest journalists of our era on, and this is the same guy who came up to me and said, Kraz, because he always called me, he and Mike Tyson, Kraz, you got to stop putting these old broads on. We need the younger demos. But other than that, they couldn't care what I did. There was a guy who was a program director who said, if you put on an hour of total flatulence, as long as you have the big numbers, I don't care.
Sure. Here's a question from the audience about people you've interviewed. Have you ever dreaded an upcoming interview and then been pleasantly surprised as to how well it turned out? and who was it that you were interviewing? Some of these, and it, you know, if you all are interested, in Off Mic, Michael's book, he talks about this sort of stuff. So if you're interested, you should pick that up. But what, who surprised you?
Well, I don't know if you believe in the Malcolm Gladwell theory that, you know, blink, what comes to your mind immediately, you should service it, or let it service you. But I remember being on edge about interviewing Patrick Buchanan, not only because I felt that it was my duty to really go after him and challenge him. And I feel, frankly, that that's my duty with anybody in the political realm. I don't care if they're on the left or the right. I feel that that's almost a kind of sacred responsibility. But I knew I was going to be challenging him in ways that made me feel uncomfortable before I went on the air. And he was charming. I mean, that's the only word that comes to mind, you know. And subsequently, I found out that he can be very disarmingly pleasant and amicable. Genial, really, would be the word that comes most swiftly to mind about him. You know, I started at him in an inquisitory way and said, oh, are we going to go to the greatest hits here, you know? And it was a bit neutralizing. And it turned out to be actually a very – he responded to my – manner, I think, which is not hostile. It can be tough, but I don't begin in an antagonistic way, regardless of what the content is.
Well, and let's talk about that toughness, because your questions can be very hard-hitting, but you have a way of, first of all, you're very civil, but I think even when they're hard-hitting, they're thoughtful enough that it's not totally knocking somebody back on their heels. I'm just wondering how you, you know, is it...
Well, it's generous of you to put it that way. I think sometimes I step over the line, frankly. With Rose Pack today, I was wondering, in fact, about that because, you know, I was we were going around this whole dance about, are you a lobbyist? Well, you may not be a paid lobbyist, but, you know, you're lobbying, and what does it mean that people see you as the most powerful person short of maybe Ron Conway or Willie Brown in all of San Francisco? And you certainly have had a lot of effect on projects that were developed. I mean, I had to ask those kinds of questions, and she took him on, you know, to her credit. But at the same time, I knew I could upset her. I mean, because I have upset people on the air. I mean, in Off Mic, I write about Betty Friedan actually walking off.
And what had you done? What made that happen?
Actually,
what'd you do?
It was not even necessarily entirely prompted by me. It was. She came in with a lot of criticism about the book that she had published called A Life So Far, which was her autobiography. And for those of you who don't know Betty Friedan, she was a major figure in, I suppose we could call the second wave of feminism, or maybe the third. Sometimes hard to separate. But she wrote a book called The Feminine Mystique, which had an enormous amount of influence, especially on women who felt that they didn't have enough of a life just being wife mothers, as Kate Chopin would put it, right? They wanted some identity outside of the home. I had her on, and I'd had her on before, and she had published this autobiography, and her ex-husband said that it was full of lies, that she alleged that he beat her up. He said he never beat her up. We started talking about this. It's hard to avoid, and, you know, it was all over the New York papers, the Post, and its big, you know, Rupert Murdoch headlines and stuff. And I said, well, did he beat you up or didn't he, you know? And she said, well, you know, I gave as good as I got. And I said, does that mean you punched him? You know, we got into this whole thing. And it turned out that in her book, she wrote about him abusing her and then going, she would go to a NOW meeting, a National Organization of Women meeting. And anyway, this was the material, and she was answering perfectly. And then I started asking her about other things in her book, and these were just questions really tailored to what was in her book. She said that she had her problems with Gloria Steinem, she had her problems with Bella Abzug, she had her problems with Susan Faludi, which I had heard about from Susan. And so, you know, I asked her about this, and I could tell she was getting pretty touchy, but it was right there in her book. And someone called up and said, Michael, I think you're trying to show that there's too much divisiveness between feminists by the questions you're asking. I was just asking her, really, Scout's Honor, what was in her book. And she says, I agree with this caller. I'm sick and tired of you people in the goddamn media. I said, Mr. Dan, I take umbrage at your putting me in whatever category you've just put me in, you know? And she said, ripped off her headphones and said, this interview is over. Huh. And started walking out of the studio. And I look at the clock and there's about 25 minutes left, you know. And, you know, I must tell you, and I don't mean this necessarily in any harsh way, my instinct told me, talk to her the way you would talk to a child. And I said, Miss Verdan, you're not in the enemy camp here. We've had amicable interviews in the past. Please come back and sit here. I don't want any enmity between us. I mean, diplomatic. And that was it. She came back and sat down, and we finished the interview. Thank heavens. I mean, I would have been thinking, do you tap dance? What do you do?
What about, you know, you have such a range of guests on the program. A friend of mine, you know, I did sort of a straw poll in my own family and my friends. You know, what would you ask Michael Krasny? And a friend of mine said, the Kim Gordon interview, we used to be with Sonic Youth, which was a couple of months ago. He was just fascinated by the way you handled that. And I'm wondering, how do you handle stuff that you know, you may well be, and you probably are, a great Sonic Youth fan, but it seems like you are able to, when things may not be in your wheelhouse, you're able to run with it. And I'm wondering what you do.
I do so little about
cases.
Kim Gordon. And I must confess, it was a learning curve for me to learn about her music and to learn about her and so forth. But, you know, I'm interested and I'm curious and I like learning about all kinds of things. And so she was suggested, strongly recommended by one of my producers. The result was a bit of a disaster. I mean, this happened with David Byrne. It's happened with a few musicians where they're very creative and able as musicians, but they can't talk. And again, I hope I don't sound harsh in saying that. She just had, and it wasn't a public speaking fear, you know, she just had a way of speaking that was inarticulate, groping, a lot of pauses, not able to express herself well, okay? I mean, fine musician, singer, right, so forth.
Right.
And so I found it, you know, very challenging. I don't mind telling you. And, you know, you have those kind of interviews. You just do the best you can and keep trying to draw the person out as best you can.
And at this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is author, scholar, and award-winning radio host of KQED Forum, Michael Krasny. I'm Peter Orner, your moderator for tonight's discussion. We already have a number of written questions from our audience, and I'd like to remind those of you here tonight that you may now line up at the microphone to ask a live question of Michael Krasny. Here's a question. There's an increasing amount of research being done at places like Stanford, UC Berkeley, and UC Davis, all pointing to the link between gratitude, forgiveness, and compassion, and better health. Do you have any plans for covering this trend on Forum?
Oh, we have. We did a program with the Stanford professor who's been leading this whole program of forgiveness. We've done programs with the Berkeley professor who's been doing all this research on gratitude. And they were, I thought, really illuminating and important programs. And you can find them in our archives. But it's not necessarily to say that we're done with the topic. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you go on and revisit topics, and especially if there's new research or if there's what we call a hook in journalism, you know, if there's something to connect to the story, newsworthy or whatever.
I want to move into literature for a bit. And I know some of your heroes are Saul Bellow, Franz Kafka, Philip Roth, and Joyce Carol Oates, and others. I'm wondering if you could, because literature is a huge part of the program, I'm wondering if you could talk about why that is and how you're able to get your love of reading across to the rest of us.
I hope it's infectious.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was not that much of a reader when I was in high school. I was, you know, I've talked about my youth as being somewhat transgressive, and it was. But by the time I got to college, I began to think of myself as someone who wanted knowledge and who wanted to be an intellectual and wanted to learn as much as I possibly could, realizing that that would be a lifetime pursuit. And I became a fairly omnivorous reader, and as the years went by, I continued and was quite passionate about literature. And one of the things about literature that I tell my students and have for lo these many years is, if you're interested in a lot of things, if you're interested in history, anthropology, science, you know, the arts and so forth, you can learn so much through reading novels. And for that matter, reading poetry, reading any genre of what literature is. I've certainly, I hope, gleaned an immense amount in terms of what I like to think at this stage of my life is some wisdom and knowledge as well. And the two don't always go together.
Of course.
So I became passionate about literature and enamored of it, but I decided to devote my life to it. You know, it was like a calling. I was going to be a scholar and a teacher, and I was going to write it. I was going to be the take the torch and be the next great American novelist. The problem was I had limited talents. You know, to be interviewed by Peter Werner, who's a very talented and gifted writer, and I don't say that to flatter him. I've read his work, and I know his work, and it's very praiseworthy, and what I say is sincere. In some ways, I wanted to be maybe you at a younger stage of my life. And Terry Gross once said to me, I wanted to be a novelist, but I didn't hear those voices. I never heard the voices, but I also just didn't have the imagination. Somebody once said to me, well, you're a scholar and you're a journalist. Maybe you're just not a good liar, which, you know, novelists really have to be. No offense, Peter.
Right, no, it's God knows it's true. And I should say I wanted to be on WXRT in Chicago. That was what I wanted. So let's talk about your writing and your nonfiction, which probably has elements of fiction in it even. I'm wondering if you could talk especially about spiritual envy and your being an agnostic and how this relates to how you approach questioning on the air, in your life. You seem to be someone, and if you listen to you and then read you, you get a real sense of somebody who is constantly not certain. And I say that in the best way, because I feel like the people who are certain about stuff are the people I often want to steer clear of. And you have this way of being uncertain in a way that I think brings out more knowledge. You talk about learned ignorance.
Generous of you. Yeah. Sometimes uncertainty can be wishy-washiness, as I say.
Well, does it not be wishy-washy is my question.
Well, I think if my father used to say to me, don't be afraid to say you don't know. And I do think it can take a modicum of courage to actually say I don't know about things that really matter. And I think I've been a seeker my whole life, certainly my whole adult life, and wanted answers. In fact, spiritual envy, as the title suggests, is the desire for answers when people have really the element of faith that gives them answers, or at least gives them a sense of a path or a discipline. And I looked into all of those, and I came up with, you mentioned Studs Terkel. I remember interviewing him and saying, he said he was an agnostic. And I said, what does that mean, to you, that you call yourself an agnostic? It says, and Studs said, it means I'm a cowardly atheist. Okay. So about as good a definition as I've heard. But I thought to myself, if I'm an agnostic, and maybe that's what I am, because I want to believe in God, and I know that when I had a deep belief in God, it meant a great deal to me. What does it mean to be an agnostic? And I just went on a quest to find out what it meant. And what it meant was what Socrates and many of the skeptics and traditions that are tied to skepticism in ancient Greece and in China and so forth say, which is just, I don't know about so many things. And I found that the atheism that was rife at the time, and I interviewed, what I call somewhat irreverently the trinity of atheists. I mean, Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, all very bright men and all very engaging men to talk to. But they were certain in their atheism, and they had a lot of contempt for religion. And it was easy at that time, especially with all of the Bush stuff that was going on, to feel contemptuous toward religion. But the truth of the matter is I always had respect for people who had faith.
Well, that comes out very clearly in the book, is that you have not just a respect, reverence as well to people who believe. And
not all people.
Not all. No. I get that. But people who believe with integrity to go deeper. Yeah. I mean, and here's a quote from the book. This is one that particularly struck me, because it struck me as, again, being like, okay, here I have this sort of poor uncertainty, and yet it manifests itself in this way. And here's a quote from the book. I can hear the true believer hectoring me. When you need God, then you will surely call on him, as you did when you went down on your knees during the Cuban Missile Crisis. When you fear for your life or the lives of the ones you love, you will need God. Could you respond to that? Because it seemed to me that gets to the crux of the matter, is, when you don't know.
Well, when you're in the foxhole or you're helpless,
foxhole, yeah.
You know, that's the old athogem about needing God or wanting to call upon, or even wanting to call upon a higher power for gratitude, feeling, you know, that your life has been blessed or good fortune has been your lot. There are many of those kinds of feelings that you, even if you don't know, you can't deny, I think. But I also think that doubting is a part of who I am. And that's really what I was trying to say in that book. And when I ask questions on the air, it's always coming from, to some extent, that perspective of realizing that there's, you know, I'm a fairly, I like to think, learned man. I've certainly read enough books to qualify for that, but I'm also an ignorant man in many ways. I mean, when I talk to people today about how the new tunnel, the two twin tunnels, the Tom Lantos tunnels, as they're called, were constructed and the design of them, or when I talk to somebody who happens to be a nuclear physicist or something, I realize how, as the British would say, bloody ignorant I am. But I'm also really curious and want to find out what I don't know.
And it seemed to me that in that quote and throughout Spiritual Envy, you're honest about what you don't know in a way that doesn't undercut your argument, but actually enhances it. Because it, you know, it's not that I don't know, and so I'm going to just fold up my tent. I don't know, and I'm going to keep seeking. And that's what struck me in the book, and as well as your career in general, that you're seeking, even in the tunnel discussion today. Here's a question. This might be out of left field, but we're going to do it anyway. Do you think Obama should go to Iran? And if not, why not? What do you think, Michael?
You're asking me for an editorial opinion here.
Yes. Do you have any certainties on this question?
No, but I think, you know, I don't see... I mean, if he does go, if he decides to go, he's going to get a shellacking. I mean, but people on the right hate him so much now that it wouldn't necessarily exceed. I mean, remember, Mitch McConnell said the one thing we have to be dedicated to in this next election is defeating Barack Obama. And I do listen to, you know, the right-wing radio stations, and I hear what they have to say, and they really hate him. I mean, it's loathing. It's despising. So if he goes to Iran, he gives them all that much more ammunition. But you know something? He doesn't have to run again. because he can't run again. And the truth of the matter is, like my mother would say, could it hurt? I mean, if you're communicating, and I've said this on the air, so I'm not talking just about Iran. If you know, here's Obama going to Israel now. It would be great if they could just sit down and start talking again. You know, I'm not terribly hopeful or idealistic about the peace process there or about Iran under a really terrible theocracy, mullahs running the lives of individuals, and it's tyranny. That's the only way to describe it. You saw what happened in the Green Revolution. I mean, and one can only hope that that country will find some sense of liberation, and yet here's all of this antagonism, and where is it moving us? It's moving us more and more toward an impasse that can't be passed. And, you know, I could say the same thing about North Korea, really. I mean, you know, this was the axis of evil, right, for past president, Iran and North Korea and Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And I could see where you could look at North Korea's regime. Now they're talking about nuking us and say this is evil and they're our enemy. And you could certainly look at Iran building nuclear weapons and say we have. There's got to be talk. Movement in some way forward to break the ice.
And I think it's not surprising that people ask you these kinds of questions. You know, should we go into Iran? Let's ask Michael Krasny. Because you have an approach that is reasonable often. When you ask questions, I think we get that vibe. Here's another one.
President I'm not a policymaker, though, rest assured.
Well, of course. And yet, you know, you can't help but wade into this. And this is here's a question. President Obama is in the Middle East, as you mentioned, trying to restart peace negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians. But is peace possible between Hamas and Gaza and the Fatah and the West Bank? And, you know, this comes up on your program. You've done numerous programs about the Middle East. You had J Street on the other day. Any thoughts on how you get two parties that have incredibly fundamental disagreements to sit down?
Yeah, I think there has to be. Dennis Ross had a piece, you know, the former negotiator under President Clinton, and actually worked in the Bush administration as well. And he had an outline in the New York Times, it was about a week ago, in fact, about what each side, in order to build some modicum of trust, may have to give up. That means the settlements. That means assurances from the Palestinian where borders and security are concerned. That means even bringing in a peace force if necessary. All of these kinds of things that could at least move the process to some small degree, or one hopes to a larger degree, forward. But when they're talking, I mean, when Abbas is talking today, still talking about refugees in Jerusalem and the right of return and so forth, and Israel's talking about, you know, not moving an inch on the settlements and not talking to Fatah. I mean, remember that under Fatah, there is almost a kind of reasonableness compared to Hamas. But also, at one time, there could be no talking to Fatah. And yet there is the possibility of talking now, and there has been talking that went on. So I'm somewhat heartened by that. It's like when people say to me, how do you ever expect any movement? I say, because who would have expected South Africa to become a democracy with Nelson Mandela as the head of state? Who would have expected the Soviet Union to break up in the Cold War? Who would have expected, for example, the kinds of things that were absolutely beyond our ken and beyond our prescience of predicting any possibility of? And so one can hope. One can hope that things will somehow be resolved in Syria, although I'm not very hopeful about that. One can hope that there can be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But even if there is, with Fatah, you have Hamas split off from Fatah. You've also got Hezbollah with a very strong presence in Lebanon. I mean, these things seem irreconcilable, and yet so did South Africa.
And implicit in the question and in your response is that talk, honest talk, hard talk is necessary to solve these kind of what we think of as intractable problems. But has there been, and not to put you on the spot, but on your program, have there been times when you've felt that you've broken through in that way, that you've had two opposing sides meet, if not meet, but break through some kind of wall?
I have. And I think I can tell you that in the instances when that occurs, it's playing to the goodwill as much as one can as an interlocutor, which is just my role. It's a minor role, but it is trying to play to the goodwill and the better angels, as Lincoln would put it, of two very, in some cases, hostile and opposing sides. I mean, I can get off a program, having done a program with a representative from the Palestinians, a representative from the Israelis, or, for that matter, the Pakistanis and the Indian government, and both sides will attack me. Mm-hmm. They'll say that I was unfair because they'll hear things that, and I know that almost in a kind of stopwatch way, I'm giving both sides equal time. I'm being as fair navigating between the differences as almost as humanly possible for me at least to do. But when people talk and when they see the humanity of another person and when they even can use a little levity, you know, I remember talking to a member of Monty Python once who said, there are two forces, gravity and levity, you know. And to bring some humor and humanity into a discussion and to make the others aware, and sometimes that can be a role of an interlocutor, to make, you know, look at what he's, listen to what he's saying, listen to what she's saying, you know, have you heard that before? And then sometimes they'll say, well, you know, it's words, and words are cheap, it's just rhetoric, it doesn't really matter, you know, and so forth. But sometimes you get under that. And those are magical moments. Those are really very special moments.
You mentioned humor, and it's always hard to talk about humor because once you start talking about it, you know, it loses its comedy factor. But your show is funny, and you are funny often on the show in ways that I think are sometimes surprising, especially, as you say, in conversations that maybe wouldn't be laugh out loud. Right.
Are you laughing
funny
at me or with me?
With that's you, right. Usually. You know, but I find that you're able to, you know, puncture that sort of tenseness that is sometimes present, especially when you're talking about something like the Middle East.
You know, humor can be very potent. Yeah. I mean, look at what Jon Stewart does, for example, or Stephen Colbert. Yeah. I mean, they're really extremely able at breaking through a lot of times just with the humor. Although sometimes it can be very hurtful. I just happen to... maybe very hurtful is too strong, but I just happened to do an interview at the both on the air and at the Computer Science Museum with Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, and he'd been on Colbert. And he said, oh, don't mention it, Michael, don't mention it. Because what happened was he came on, he was talking all this computer science jargon talk, you know, in his new book, Citizenville. Gavin's become kind of a would-be nerd or geek or something, I don't know. And he started talking in that language, in that argot, really, which is what it was. And Colbert said to him, we need a bullshit translator here, you know. But he laughed.
We have a question, sir.
So I'm a bit older than you, and I've been a news hound all my life. And when I was growing up, you had the newspaper, and you had Walter Cronkite, and the Huntley-Brinkley Report. You really only had a very limited number of ways to get your news. Mm-hmm. Today, you have this unlimited source between the Internet and 24-hour talk TV. I'm not a TV watcher, but I spend a lot of time on the Internet. And actually, the value of papers is declining. So across the arc of your career, are we better informed or less informed as this has changed?
It's a good and thoughtful question. I think in many ways we're better informed because there's so much more access to so much more knowledge. But a lot of the knowledge is pretty crappy. A lot of certainly what is put out there on the Internet, what's blogged and et cetera, what comes under the rubric of citizen journalism is not necessarily quality journalism or professional or even that edifying. So you really have to go to the sources you trust and you have to find out who those sources are. But there's an infinite amount more than there was. I mean, I was reading mainly newspapers, magazines, and so forth, and watching some television and listening to the radio. But as you suggest, there's a myriad number of things other than that. And I can tell you this, people don't read the newspapers anymore if they're under about the age of 55. That's the average newspaper reading age. They get their news online. So everything has changed.
Here's a related question from the audience. It's about the demographics of your audience in general. And the questioner asks, what kind of can you comment on strategies for engaging younger adults in public discourse and identification with serving the common good?
Well, remember, when I was in commercial radio, everything was younger demographics. You know, you got to get them because they're the buyers and the purchasers. In fact, they used to call people, speaking about reading newspapers over the age of 55, they used to call people over the age of 55 tonnage in commercial radio because they just felt they didn't buy as much and so forth. You know, we don't necessarily aim for the millennials, but we've got them. And it's somewhat heartening that we have them. I mean, the numbers are there. We've seen them in Arbitron and other ways to gauge these metrics that we have. And they're there. They're listening to us. A lot of spike came up after 9/11. A lot of people wanted that kind of analysis and international news and so forth. But, you know, when you try to, like that program director said, you got to get the younger demos, read Madonna's sex book, that kind of thing. Nobody really knows what brings in younger demographics. If you try to do a thoughtful and intelligent talk program and you do good analysis and news, you know, it's like build it and they will come. And they do. At least that's what I've discovered. Now, when we try to do a program like, and people give us, they say, let's do a hip-hop program, you know. And people, I get complaints about this from older listeners. You know, why the hell are you doing hip-hop, Krasny? What's the matter with that? Does that bring in younger listeners or does it alienate my older listeners? I don't know. You know, I really don't know. But I do those kinds of things, frankly, because I want the diversity. I want to follow whatever divining rod I have as far as a lot of different interests, and there it is.
Let's go with another questioner. Yeah, sir.
So before I ask my question, so first of all, just to let you know, I'm very religious. I know you're agnostic, and you're not Rara, but you're very inspirational. So just wanted to get out of the way. You are very inspirational. And so the question I have is, so the Council for Parliament of Religions, it's a large inter-religious body, met in Chicago in 1993, and they had some convictions. And a couple of them were, no peace in the world is possible without peace among the religions first, and no peace among the religions is possible without dialogue and education. What are your thoughts about them?
Well, we've done a lot of interfaith programs, and, you know, they used to use the word ecumenical. Now they talk about interfaith. I'm not sure why they retired that word, but there were reasons with the etymology that they didn't like. I can tell you this. We get people who are very well-meaning when we do these interfaith shows, but they're people who like the dialogue, believe in interfaith dialogue, and are very committed. What we don't get are those people who feel the hostility. I mean, and I'm talking about some of them who are in the same branches, you know, different ways of worshiping in Protestantism, let's say, or the Orthodox Jews versus the Reformed Jews, or Sunni Muslims versus Shiite Muslims. You have people who come on public radio and, you know, they are graceful and they want to talk peace and all those kinds of things like you mentioned in the Chicago example. And sometimes I'm almost tempted, you know, to get some people who ramp it up and everything just so that the public knows where they are coming from. But it doesn't necessarily serve the listeners. What serves the listeners, I feel, is, again, a higher level of discourse. But you know it's out there. You know that antagonism is out there.
In Spiritual Envy, you talk about in your childhood, boyhood, being more devout than even your parents. And I'm wondering if you go back to some of your roots of that as we start to close down. But I'm wondering if you could talk about sort of your own relationship to faith back then and now.
Well, back then I was just a strong believer in God and believed in God's omnipotence. And write in the book about a particular incident that occurred. I was getting actually physically beaten up in the sixth grade by a British male teacher who would see me acting up and would take me out and really kind of beat the hell out of me. One time I was trying to help him and, you know, getting his good graces, and I spilled some paint and it went down. Some of you, how many of you have actually read my book? I'm just curious. So you know the story. I'm sorry if I'm repeating it, but it had a major impact on me. Not at that time, but much later. And I was...
This was somebody you were trying to ingratiate yourself
exactly.
to, even though you were
beating.
But he
sees this yellow paint, yeah. You know, like a river of paint, and he comes over and grabs me and gave me the worst beating of them all. And I went out and I started, when I was unseen by anybody, alone in the little wooded area, I started sobbing, and I thought, God, you know, you saw this. You know I was trying to be a good boy, you know. It was that absolutely untethered, complete faith in God. So, you know, it's like a British writer once said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And that's sort of where I'm at.
Sir?
We live in the Bay Area, liberal, progressive, tolerant. But yet earlier on you said you get calls from people who object when you have somebody like somebody from the Heritage Foundation, and you said you get a lot of these. Doesn't that give credence to the rights complaint that people expect, not just you individually, but your radio station to lean towards people who expect you to be the liberal, progressive, and kind of ironic, tolerant San Francisco audience?
Well, there is an expectation when what's so easily and glibly called the left coast that, you know, we serve the listeners who are by and large liberal, and, you know, they talk about Nancy Pelosi values in San Francisco and all of these kinds of things. But the truth of the matter is we do want to hear and assiduously try to hear from many different sides of the political spectrum. And I think we toe the line pretty well on that.
Would you ever do a show regarding the mess in Oakland?
Which one?
Sorry. This is specifically the Oakland VA. Follow-up to last summer's show with someone's real ideas in terms of solutions.
Well, we cover Oakland pretty well. I mean, we covered certainly, when you said mess, I thought of the schools, the occupied movement. There's a number of things that run the violence and problems with murder and so forth. But Oakland politics too. And if you're talking about the police case that's still hovering, or if you're talking about what kind of work the DA is doing under Mayor Kwan, and that's a whole subject in itself. I know we're short on time, so I'd say go to our archives. You know, I have to emphasize this because people think you turn it on at 9 o'clock and there it is, and you listen to it when it's on the air. You can listen any time now. You know, you can just go to kqed.org, and any show is there in the archives for you to listen to. We call it time shifting. They even have a jargon name for it. You know, you don't have to listen, and you can listen on iPod, and you can listen on iTunes, and so forth. So, final word for me is appreciate those of you who support public radio and listen to public radio, and hope that we will continue to earn your support.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question from the audience. Who composed the opening music to Forum, and how does it make you feel?
Local composer, Mike Marshall. He was consigned to do it a number of years ago. A lot of people like it. Some people say change the music. But we're comfortable with it, and I like the beat of it. We used to have a Bach melody for a while. We had a couple of different experiments with music. This one seems to serve us, and it's become our signature.
Well, thank you very much. Our thanks to literary scholar, journalist, and radio host Michael Krasny for being here with us tonight.
Can I thank Peter, too? Would you thank Peter, too, who is kind of out of water here?
Absolutely. And we all congratulate Michael on his incredible contributions to the Bay Area and the nation over the past 20 years at KQED Forum. We also thank our audiences here in Lafayette and on the radio, television, and Internet. I'm Peter Orner. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where in the know, that's in quotes, is adjourned. And I'm going to hit the gavel now. My stepfather was mayor of my hometown, so I've always wanted to do this in his honor. So here we go. Thank you.